Lecture 7, The Athenians Build a Fleet.
Welcome back. Last time we followed the preparations of the Persian king Xerxes over a space of 3 years for a massive invasion of the Greek world. We left Xerxes on the road, the royal road from Susa, his capital, going to Sardis at the western end of his empire over there in Western Asia Minor, and leading an immense army drawn from all the satrapies of his empire for the invasion of Greece. When Xerxes got to Sardis, it was the autumn of the year 481 BC. He went into winter quarters there because in the classical world, in that world of the Aegean and of Anatolia, Western Asia, nobody fought in the wintertime. That was the season of rainy weather, storms, muddy roads, difficult mountain passes that were sometimes blocked with snow, and above all, an army could not bivouac in the open, so you couldn't have these men camping out in their thousands as you could in the dry, warm summer months. So summer's the time for warfare, autumn and winter are the time for getting yourself under cover and waiting for spring. We'll find that this has important strategic implications for the whole campaign as the Greeks turn this to their advantage. Xerxes and his arrival at Sardis were announced in the Greek world by messengers, and the Spartans convened an assembly of those Greeks who were willing to stand up to the Persians and try to resist the invasion. They called that convention of the resistance at the Isthmus of Corinth, the place in the center of Greece where Greece narrows down to a little tiny neck of land between north-central Greece, where you find Athens and Thebes and Mount Olympus and the Delphic Oracle, and southern Greece called the Peloponnesus, where you find Sparta and Corinth and the site of the Olympic Games. At this narrow isthmus, sacred to the sea god and earthshaker Poseidon, they met in the sanctuary of Poseidon under his sacred pine trees, and the Spartans asked for votes on what people thought the course should be for preparing to resist the Persians. In the end, out of all the hundreds of islands and cities of the Greek world, only 31 proved willing to stand up to the Persians. And among these was the city of Athens, and the Athenians had chosen to send to the isthmus one of their citizens as their counselor, their representative, a man named Themistocles. As they conferred, they all agreed that they should send spies across the sea to Sardis to count the Persian forces and give the Greeks some idea of what they were up against. So 3 Greeks were dispatched in a boat across the Aegean. They made their way to Sardis. I think they probably felt confident that among so many other Greeks, since Xerxes had lots of Eastern Greeks fighting for him in his army, that they, those 3 spies from the mainland of Greece, could escape detection. But they didn't. They were apprehended. And they were about on the point of being executed when Xerxes learned that there were 3 spies from Greece in his camp. And he sent a messenger saying, "Do not kill these men. Show them everything they want to see, give them a full count of the army, and send them home." So that's what they did. The Persians conducted them around the camp. They showed them the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of men, of cavalry, of pack animals. They explained all the preparations. They gave them a count of the ships, and they sent them home. And this was the terrifying report then that reached the Greeks in their conference at the Isthmus of Corinth that probably also led to the huge figures we have in histories like that of Herodotus, which put Xerxes' forces at 1.7 million and his fleet of ships at 1,200, more than Agamemnon was supposed to have taken to Troy for the Trojan War. This probably came from Xerxes' war of nerves and propaganda, where he's trying to convince the Greeks he's just too big to be resisted. Now, there's a certain theory of history which states that history is all about monumental movements of people, mass movements of people. This was first articulated, as far as I know, in the 1860s by Leo Tolstoy in his work War and Peace, which chronicles Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812. And if you think of parallels for Xerxes' invasion of Greece, that invasion of 1812 seems the closest in all of human history. A whole continent, the continent of Europe, marshaled together by Napoleon under the banner of France and on the move to conquer a distant land. Tolstoy drew from that epic the lesson for history that history is all about the movements of people. Great men don't make history. Great men are just the labels that history puts upon events, and like all labels, they have very little to do with the real events. Napoleon didn't invade Russia. Europe invaded Russia and took Napoleon with it. In this theory of history, this comforting theory, to which I'm sure Xerxes himself would have subscribed, the idea that it's all just great forces of destiny, unstoppable by any individual, it's a very comforting thing for all of us because it allows us to be off the hook. No individual can stop the great train of historical events. It's an illusion to think that you can. And so we are all somehow blameless for the things that go on in this world. The Greeks never bought that idea. And it's one of the things that separates the Greek mind and approach from the mindset that was very common in the Asiatic world and revived in our modern times by Tolstoy. It became the basis for the social sciences approach to history in the 20th and 21st century. The idea that history is just mass movements of faceless populations and individuals may appear to be leading the way, but they don't really. The man who subscribed least to this theory was Themistocles. And it's an extraordinary thing to think that Xerxes, the great king, king of kings, king of the world, sitting there in Sardis, surrounded by the biggest army that the human race had ever seen, was about to be opposed by one man, a man named Themistocles, a citizen of Athens, who even though he'd been elected general sometimes and had led the city as archon or chief magistrate for a year, had no autocratic powers whatever, could do nothing except persuade his fellow citizens in their democratic assembly to take one course or another, who lived in a city street with his wife, Archippe, and a brood of boys and girls, their children that they were bringing up, a man who had inherited from his father a very modest fortune, who didn't stand high in the aristocracy of Athens. This was the man who was convinced that he could defeat Xerxes, this single citizen of a small democratic city. Themistocles was laughed at by the aristocrats of Athens because he'd never bothered to learn the accomplishments of an Athenian gentleman. And he told them, "It's true. I cannot play a lyre or tune a harp, but I know how to make a small city great." What quality would enable a man to say this? It's a quality that the Greeks prized and that the Persians despised. If we think back to Cyrus in his first confrontation with the Greeks, telling them that he can't respect them or fear them, they're just men who make speeches and cheat each other, that cheating each other, that use of craft and cunning was the essence of the Greek approach to life. We talked about Aesop being part of the great Ionian tradition. Aesop is all about the counterintuitive, the fact that you can find a way around the obvious conclusion to events if you're willing to put your mind to it. The quality is called metis, M-E-T-I-S. Metis is something we don't have a word for in English. It means something like cunning intelligence. It's looking for points of leverage in a situation where you can shift enormous forces one way or the other just through art or craft. And one of the examples the Athenians had for it, as well as the other Greeks, was what happens on a ship, a trireme. Here are 200 men. 200 men, 170 at the oars, others working the ship and ready to fight. Who determines what happens to that ship, its fate, its potential for winning a battle? One man, the man at the steering oars. With the leverage that he exerts, he can direct that ship and the forces and labors of all those 200 to his purpose. And this was Themistocles' view. He got it as he grew up also from Homer. There's a beautiful passage toward the end of the Iliad on how to win a chariot race when your horses aren't the fastest horses. It's spoken by old King Nestor, who's the giver of advice to the Greeks, and he's here giving advice to his son, who is trying to win this race. I'll give it to you in Alexander Pope's translation, where metis is represented by the word art. But we need to remember that art here is, as in our adjective, artful, crafty, thinking things through. It is not strength but art that wins the prize, for to be strong is less than to be wise. 'Tis more by art than force of numerous strokes the dexterous woodman shapes the stubborn oaks. By art the pilot through the boiling deep and howling tempest steers the well-built ship. And 'tis the artist wins the glorious course, not those who trust in chariot or in horse. This was the philosophy of Themistocles, and this was what had guided him through his public career in Athens as he sought to make Athens the greatest city in the Greek world and himself the greatest and first man in that city. He was an ambitious man, and his ambition served his patriotism and his desire to help save Athens and Greece from the invasion of Xerxes. Themistocles had already exerted himself 3 years earlier, in that same year when Xerxes' engineers were digging the canal through Mount Athos. Themistocles took advantage of a chance discovery in the hills outside Athens of an immense vein of silver ore. The mines of Mount Laurion had been worked for generations, but just before the Persian Wars, in one of the great coincidences of world history, the Athenian miners, burrowing down in their tunnels hundreds of feet below the surface, suddenly hit this vast reef of silver ore. They brought it up in bag after bag, bucket after bucket to the surface. It was pounded, washed, refined, and turned into those beautiful silver coins called owls, the owls of Athens, with Athena's head on one side and her helmet to show she was always ready for war, and on the other side, her owl, the bird that is the symbol of wisdom. It was proposed that the Athenians simply divide among themselves all this windfall of silver so every citizen would receive 10 drachmas. There were 30 to 40,000 citizens. Themistocles had stood up in the summer of 483 BC and said in the Democratic Assembly, "Don't divide the money. Let's keep it all together and let us build a navy, a fleet of 100 triremes this year and add to it every year more and more until we will have a fleet of 200 ships and be the greatest naval power in the Greek world." And he pointed out, he wasn't even talking about the Persians then, he picked a closer target that was an island near Athens, the island of Aegina, that was a rival to Athenian shipping, and he pointed to those troublesome neighbors and said, "This will at last give us the upper hand here at home." He was a good psychologist as well as everything else. So the Athenians agreed. They voted to build those ships. They had spent now 3 years in building up this navy, and now they were the masters of the greatest fleet in the entire world of the Greek city-states. Now it was time that they'd learned that Xerxes was in Sardis, that he was headed for the Hellespont. He was going to take his great army across into Europe, crossing those pontoon bridges. Now it was time to seek the advice of the Delphic Oracle about what the Athenians should do. They knew they were the targets of Xerxes' invasion, the ostensible targets. They were the pretext for invading Greece. And they were fearful, and it was also right and pious if you were a religious Greek, and all Greeks were religious except for a few philosophers, to go and consult the Oracle of Apollo at Delphi. Now, we started at the Delphic Oracle in our very first lecture. We were there when King Croesus of Lydia inquired of the god through his envoys, "Should I attack the Persians or should I wait and let them attack me?" And he had been told, "If you cross the river, you will destroy a great empire." He did cross the river, and he did destroy a great empire. It just turned out to be his own. Despite this kind of ambiguous answer and the mixed record of those who tried to follow Delphic oracular pronouncements, Greeks still thought it was the right thing to do, to go and ask. So envoys from Athens were sent on the journey to Delphi. They climbed up the mountainside. They got in line on that day, the seventh day after the new moon, and they went down into the crypt of the temple and they asked their question, "What should Athens do?" And the woman, seated on her tripod there, in the heart of the temple, with her little dish of holy water from the spring underneath her in one hand, her branch of the Apollo the sacred bay of Apollo, the laurel leaves in the other hand, and seated over that crack in the earth, breathing in those fumes, she said to them, "Fly, leave your city. Nothing can save you. Athens will be destroyed. I see the temples with blood on them. I see the gods weeping. Save yourselves." Well, they went back out into the light of day, these envoys, appalled. There was nothing cryptic or riddling about this response. And in their despair, they sat down and they shared their feelings with their friend in Delphi, who was the Athenian representative and who had conducted them down into the temple. And he said, "Try again. Get back in line. Go through and ask the god one more time. You don't want to take that message home." So they did get back in line. No one had ever done this. And they went down a second time. She only prophesied once a month. So they asked her again, and she said, "Zeus cannot save Athens, but he will grant to Athena, the goddess of Athens, a wooden wall which will stand and not fall, a wooden wall to preserve the Athenians." Well, there was a ray of hope, so they took it home, and it was debated in the assembly. The conservative element in Athens thought that the wooden wall was the palisade of wood around the Acropolis, that high rock in the middle of Athens that had the temples on top. And so they were all for just going up on the top of the rock and waiting out the invasion there, maybe under siege, but with some sort of guarantee that the wooden wall would not fall. There were probably others who wanted to abandon Athens altogether, load their wives and children and their belongings in their ships, and sail off to the far west of the Mediterranean, get out of the path of this juggernaut of the Persian invasion, and found a new city in a safe place. Other Greeks had already done this. The Greeks from Phocaea in Asia Minor had gone off and founded Marseille in southern France. They called it Massalia. So the idea of getting away and founding a new city, moving a whole population, was not a novel one. It was at this point that Themistocles stood up and said, "I believe I understand the meaning of this oracle. The wooden walls are the hulls of our ships, of this navy that we have just built. The god is telling us to face the Persians at sea, to leave our land, to carry our wives and children to safety on the islands or on the Peloponnese. But for all of us Athenian men, whether we are riders or hoplite infantry or ordinary citizens, to get in those ships, man those oars, and fight it out on the water." And he's saying this to the group of people who could still remember 10 years earlier how they or their fathers had beaten the Persians on land in the battle at Marathon. So persuasive was he that he carried the day. The vote was with Themistocles' interpretation of the wooden wall's oracle, and he was able to go back to the Isthmus of Corinth in the summer of the year 480, after Xerxes had crossed the Hellespont, after Xerxes was already headed down into central Greece with his huge army and his fleet of 1,200 ships paralleling his motion along the coast, and tell the Spartans, the Corinthians, all those other Greeks, that Athens was going to fight at sea. Why did he think this? Why was this his strategy? Themistocles was a rough contemporary with a famous Chinese military thinker named Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu had a golden rule: do not attack the enemy's strength, attack the enemy's weakness. He had another golden rule: know the terrain. Themistocles subscribed to both of these. He knew the terrain. He knew the course that the fleet of Xerxes was going to have to follow if it wanted to get down into Greek waters around Athens. He knew that there was a place they would have to pass through a narrow channel of water between north-central Greece and the northern tip of the island of Euboea at a place called Artemision, sacred to the goddess Artemis. Through that channel, Xerxes' ships would have to pass. He would not be with them. And if the Greeks could post themselves there on the beach at Artemision, they would be able to block the progress, in Themistocles' view, of the Persian armada. And for Themistocles, that's a great victory, because if they can stop the fleet from coming in, Xerxes' land army will wait for the fleet. The whole invasion will be delayed. If they can hold it up for a month or 6 weeks, the winter storms will arrive, the fleet will have to go home, and the army will be stuck in Greece without proper supplies. The great invasion will probably peter out, die of its own weight, lose momentum, and the battle will be won. This was the strategy of Themistocles. Meet the Persians as far forward as possible, block their advance, slow them down, delay the entry into Greece, and do it at sea. Why did he think the sea was the place? He heard the reports on the grand army of Xerxes. He knew that with that immense cavalry, anytime they caught the Greeks out in the open, they could simply surround them and crush the Greeks on land by sheer force of numbers. Also, the Persian cavalry and their ability to shoot those arrows from a horseback at a full gallop, that was something the Greeks didn't know how to do. And it meant that the cavalry could surround and pepper with arrows any infantry force if they could get them on flat land and ultimately overwhelm them. The navy was very different. Yes, it was huge, 1,200 ships supposedly. Even with the non-Athenians added on, the people from Corinth and Aegina and the other freedom-fighting Greek states who had ships, the Greeks could only muster about 300 of these big triple-tiered triremes. Xerxes had four times that number. But this was his Achilles heel in Themistocles' view. Themistocles looked at the forces that were headed for them, and he saw on land a great army, not only led by Xerxes, but with a core that was pure Persian, the most fearsome fighting force in the world, mobile, tough, big, successful, except for Marathon, a little battle won by the Athenians back in 490, no record of defeat. The navy was different. The Persians were completely inexperienced at sea. It turned out that Xerxes had appointed six admirals for his fleet. Six! What do you do with a divided command at sea? Who's going to be making the decisions? Who were these six? Were they experienced Persian seafarers? There was no such thing. They were just members of Xerxes' own family that through a process of nepotism, he had given the title of admiral to so that they would have this nice title to carry with them as they marched on Greece. Some of them weren't even with the fleet. They were marching with Xerxes on land. They were part of his great court. They would sit with Xerxes in his immense pavilion, this gigantic tent that was his field headquarters that was set up every night. And there they would be feasting and drinking with their kinsman, the king. They didn't know anything about the ships. And if you looked at the navy itself, it had one strength. Its core was a group of Phoenician ships. But the Venetians did not have a great track record as fighters at sea. They were great explorers at sea. They were great traders and merchants. As I said, they had circumnavigated Africa in their triremes, but they hadn't won many battles. So even the core element of the fleet looked vulnerable to Themistocles. And when he added in the consideration that the fleet was this jumble of contingents from many nations, Egypt, Phoenicia, Cyprus, Cilicia, and those Ionian Greeks who were fighting on Xerxes' behalf with, as Themistocles guessed, very mixed emotions. This is why Themistocles thought, if you are going to attack the enemy's weakness, attack Xerxes at sea. He went back to the Isthmus. He explained what Athens intended to do to the Spartans. And I'm sure he didn't say it to the Spartans, but we have to realize this was part of Themistocles' other plan, this man of Metis. He not only wants to beat Xerxes and save Athens, he wants to use this crisis as an opportunity to catapult Athens out of the rank of second-class Greek cities and make it the leader of the Greek world. Yes, times of danger are times of danger. Things can go terribly wrong. You can lose everything. But if you're willing to take the risks, the big risks, the rewards can be far greater than you will ever get through small increments of progress in times of stability and peace. Themistocles knew that, and he was staking everything on Athens' behalf on being able to lift his city up and make that small city, as he liked to say, a great city, the greatest in all the Greek world. At the Isthmus of Corinth, this pronouncement was thrown in with all of the others, that the Athenians were going to meet the barbarian, as they called the Persians, at sea, and that they were going to go far north to Artemisium to do it, having evacuated their wives and children so that they wouldn't be leaving potential hostages behind them if the Persians got around and marched on Athens. The Spartans are now left with a dilemma. They want to be the leaders of the whole Greek resistance. They feel that they should be the prime hegemon, the sort of leading force or chief state within this alliance, this league of cities and islands who are trying to keep out the Persians. So the Athenians have, in a way, thrown down the gauntlet. They are saying, we are taking the lead at sea. What are you going to do? The majority of the Peloponnesians, if you had taken a head count, were quite willing to vote to leave all of north and central Greece to the Persians, to build a great wall across the Isthmus of Corinth. In fact, they'd already started building that wall, and sit behind it on this semi-island of land, which was only approachable through this narrow neck, the isthmus itself. They didn't think this through. They didn't really stop to think that if Xerxes commands the sea, he can go to any part of the Peloponnesian coast and land. But that was their plan. And it was with some difficulty that the Spartans made their allies agree that if the fleet is going north, the land force should go north with them. Now, Artemisian Channel is at the north end of the island of Euboea. Due west of it, on the mainland, was a narrow pass called Thermopylae. That means the hot gates. Sulfurous springs of hot bubbling water come to the surface at Thermopylae. It's a place where the mountains come down to the sea, and the path into Greece narrows to a road of such constricted span that only two carts could pass along it. Xerxes was bringing, allegedly, 1,700,000 men into Greece, but they would have to go through the pass at Thermopylae, maybe 10 abreast. His great advantage in numbers would be negated at the pass at Thermopylae in the same way that Themistocles had seen the huge numbers of the fleet would be negated in the narrow channels of Artemisium, just to the east of Thermopylae, out at sea. So the Spartans decreed that in spite of the fact that, yes, there's another festival going on, the Olympic festival, and in spite of the fact that we really need to stay here in Peloponnese and see it out for the honor of Zeus and the other gods, we will send a force to hold the pass at Thermopylae at the same time that the Athenians and the other naval powers go up and hold the channel at Artemisium. And they said, allegedly in response to demands from the non-Athenians in the alliance, we will send a Spartan to command the fleet as well, so that it would be a Spartan command both at sea and on land. The Spartan chosen to command at sea was a man named Eurybiades, and the Spartan chosen to hold the pass at Thermopylae until the main army was mobilized at the end of the Olympic festival and sent north, that Spartan was a king named Leonidas. And so it was that at the end of summer 480 BC, as Xerxes is leading his great army south past Mount Olympus, as his fleet is preparing to come down and meet him somewhere near Thermopylae, they will be separated for a while by the mountains of Greece, two contingents of freedom fighters on what looked like the most forlorn of all possible hopes went north to meet them. The fleet going to Artemisium and that little army going to Thermopylae. We mustn't over-exaggerate the size of the army that went to Thermopylae in terms of how small it was. It's popular to call it the 300 Spartans. The 300. Well, the 300 was the core of an army of 7,000, 4,000 troops from the Peloponnese, 3,000 from central Greece, plenty to hold the pass, one would think. But it will be our task in our next time together to follow these forces northward, this bold attempt to stop the greatest military force in history from getting into Greece, both on land and at sea, and both with the same policy. Use the terrain, know your enemy, fight hard, and see if you cannot change the course of history with a little courage and a little cunning.